This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Cool. So, welcome to the podcast, mate. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, and it's good we've finally been able to record something. I think it must be 2 or 3 years since we've been first had a chat about it, so it's good to be here, James.
It's been a long time coming, mate. It's good to have you on. Thank you for being patient. It's probably the best thing I should say, really.
Both sides, I think.
One of the biggest challenges in the world at the minute is just diary alignment, I find. Just everyone is so busy. Okay, cool. Right, we are going, you'll be the first guest that we have of this new structure that we're doing. So I tried it last week with Peter, who obviously you know is part of our team.
Yeah.
And it went really well. I don't think we're actually going to put that episode out because my audio, ironically, was really rubbish. So you'll actually be the first person, I think, that will put this podcast out on this. So you should, mate. I've got a plaque and I'll send you it. I haven't really out. I'm too tight to buy a plaque.
Have you said it now? So you got to.
It's canon. Yeah. Cool. So what have you, the first agenda item is what have you been up to recently?
What have I been up to recently? I suppose most immediate thing, I've been having a bit of a review in some of our premises on fire safety issues, just seeing how we're doing there. Mm-hmm. And before that, got a new member of the team, so been involved in mentoring the new team member, trying to bring up to speed of what we do and how we do things and supporting them. And I've been trying not to procrastinate too much because I started a PhD, a professional doctorate last October. So the biggest thing outside of work, I suppose, but linked to work is trying to not procrastinate too much when I should be studying instead of recording things like this.
Yeah. I'll take that as a compliment.
yeah, it's a compliment, mate. Compliment.
Because you're part of quite a big organisation. So how big is your team now then, the safety team? Is it quite a big team?
We've got over 150 operational sites, and I've got three team members in my team now. Recently, one of them left a few months ago. Fortunately, I found a replacement. I didn't actually realise how difficult it is to find good candidates in the market at the moment. Seems to be, especially at a certain sort of level I was wanting, it did seem to me not as many candidates I thought there would be, to be perfectly honest. So I don't know why that is, but fortunately we found somebody who's made a really, really good start with us. And I was looking forward to working with them over the next few years and developing and mentoring them as well.
That's interesting you're saying about them. My next question actually off the back of that was going to be, how did you find the market? Which you've already nailed that question, really. But it's we've just recently recruited Carly. She's been with us for three now. We used a recruiter. Did you go to market yourself or did you use a recruiter?
No, we started off by internal support that we've got. However, as soon as I posted on LinkedIn, I must have had about 42 recruitment companies get in touch with me. But I had an open mind, as hopeful, and luckily we did manage to find somebody in the first round. It was on the agenda that if we didn't, that we would have to go to a third party to help us. We managed to find a good candidate, so we're doing all right so far.
Yeah, that's really good. Nice. Did you, what I've been up to, last week I was in Birmingham. Did you go to Birmingham?
Yeah, I was there on day two. So with my FM colleagues, which I was really, really busy, far busier than I've seen before, especially in the afternoon. Usually they peter out quite quickly in the afternoon, but this one was a bit of a, got my steps in that day, certainly.
Yeah, it definitely felt big. It definitely felt busy as well. Yeah, for sure. So the next agenda item is what have you been pondering? And this is a point where we try to get into topics. So this is the main meat of the new structure, yep, so to speak. So has there any kind of topics or things that you've been challenges or anything like that you've got on your mind that you're like, oh, this has been bugging me whilst I've been trying for work, or you know, just pondering? What have you been pondering?
I suppose there's a couple of things that are on my agenda at the moment. One of them mentioned briefly is fire safety, because the industry I work in, it's the care home sector. It's probably one of the key risk areas we have to look at. And so I'm always pondering and wondering, how can we maintain the standards we've got? How do we make sure that people are doing what people are meeting our expectations in terms of their approach to fire safety locally? Looking, is there anything out there on the market that could help us? Different evacuation aids. Been looking at the P50 fire extinguishers. That's just popped on my agenda. And the other thing is looking at incident investigations is how we can get a more robust approach. How we can do it, can we do better? If so, how can we do better? And one of the challenges for making changes in, because we say we've got over 150 operational sites, 150 homes, it's how do you get that message to different people? How do you get the message to the people who need to know? We're all getting far more used to Teams and on online, but sometimes perhaps that misses out some of those human connections that you need. So perhaps it's a face-to-face training and development that we might need to be looking at. So there are a few things on my mind at the moment.
I'm keen to chew into them, actually, because I've got an experience background in fire in the kind of care and housing sector. It's never really been a time where that's not been complicated to navigate, really. And I always struggled with trying to find the balance between like maintaining someone's individuality and their independence of living on their own as they're going through that transition in life, and at the same time, the ability to effectively manage evacuation was always a biggest challenge I had within housing, and kind of predominantly a lot of what I was dealing with was what was like independent living, where they were kind of partly supported, if that makes sense. But an interesting challenge, and one really that I find the space has only really got more complex, which is ironic because I find Dame Judith Hackett's report, and the main thing that came out of that off the back of Grenfell, was we need to reduce complexity. And I don't think we've done that at all.
I suppose we don't really fall under the Building Safety Act. None of our buildings are high enough stories to fall under that. So that means we don't have to deal with that extra level of complexity for those buildings. One of the big things that we need to consider is we run people's homes. It's their home first and foremost. So if you're putting just a pure fire safety hat on, you're going to be thinking about austere environments, no carpet, no pictures on the walls, clean and austere
clinical
corridors.
Feel to it. Yeah,
clinical feel. But we're not institutions. We're people's homes. So getting that balance right, which, to be fair, most of the most enforcement officers from the fire and rescue services, they understand that. But every now and then, it throws things up, for example, Christmas decorations, Halloween decorations, having a few bits of extra potentially flammable items in it. But it ultimately goes back, it's that person's home, it's where they're living. So it's how do we balance those issues. And the other thing I look at is that you need to be able to trust your system. So we start off with PHE, progressive horizontal evacuation. Learn to trust your procedures, learn to trust your compartments, that your fire doors, etc., are going to give you that 30 minutes once the compartment that's got the fire in, or the where it's detected smoke or whatever, you get them past that first door, and then you continue the progressive evacuation until the fire and rescue service turn up. Hopefully they would turn up before you've had to evacuate everybody, but you got to recognize that's what you've got to do. You've got to evacuate everybody and keep them safe. So it's trusting those systems, trusting your buildings, that your building is doing what it's supposed to do.
I mean, you just touch on probably two just what seem like simple things, but they're like, when you're in that environment, they're just hugely kind of socially complex. Like you were saying, like, it's people's homes. Like, I remember I'd turn up at like a even in when I was in the NHS, like a a more clinical environment, so to speak. But you would still, so say a hospice, for example, I used to have a hospice that was attached to the hospital. And even there, like, you'd walk through the doors of the into the hospice from the hospital. That's a mouthful to say. And it would be a completely different environment. So you'd walk in and there was, all of a sudden there's carpet. All of a sudden there's curtains. All of a sudden it feels very homely. And the point of granted it's a different style of care, but like ultimately, like, the point of that is that it is their home away from home. It is in some cases their new home. And my grandma has just gone into a home, and I wouldn't want her living in somewhere that feels like a hospital 24/7. She's grumpy enough as it is. Do you know what I mean? I wouldn't want her living in a hospital being more grumpy. So it is that challenge. But what I always found quite interesting I also find there's a bit of a lack of appreciation for the challenge that creates for the fire safety professional or the health and safety professional, because ultimately they're the one that has to make the decision to say that it's okay, if that makes sense. Like, I used to find people would look at me and say, we're putting these curtains up, is that okay? And I felt like I had to be the one to say, yes, it's okay. That's quite a difficult position to put a safety professional in, because ultimately if something did go wrong, it's our predisposition, isn't it, to think about the worst case scenario. So like, you therefore feel like you want to go no because it's a means of escape or so on. It's a really hard challenge. I don't think people appreciate how challenging it actually is.
It can be challenging, and I say mixing that, the operational imperative, with what we want for health and safety people, or what the fire regs are suggesting or saying, or the guidance. And again, repeat about it's somebody's home first and foremost rather than an institution. But don't you sometimes think actually that's quite a good position to be in, is that people are looking to you wanting you to make a decision? I find that quite empowering. When I became a head of health and safety a few years ago, that was the one thing that really struck me first off, is that there's nobody above you in the organization to make a different suggestion. Nobody above you in the organization is going to, from a health and safety perspective, and having that responsibility, I enjoy it. I don't know. It's professionally, I think it's quite satisfying. Is having that sort of position.
Interesting.
I don't know if you thought that as well. Is that
I've always quite
with you.
Yeah, I have. I mean, we know each other relatively well now, Phil. Yeah. We've spoken for years, and I think we're very aligned on that. I've always seen it as an opportunity to enable people to do what they want to do. And exactly. I know that is what I really love about what we do. Like, if a customer rings me now and says, like, James, we're doing this marketing campaign, and basically what we want to do is throw Steve off a roof and record it on video, and I'm like, that is cool, let's work out how to do that. And ironically, the reason that comes to mind is that genuinely a conversation I've had in my career. So it was my first safety job was a protective packaging manufacturer, so like bubble wrap and foam and stuff like that. And we used to have you can YouTube it, I think it's still available. We used to have this thing called Professor Packaging, who basically would do stunts, and how he would protect himself would be using our packaging. And I genuinely did have a phone call one day saying, we want to throw Professor Packaging off the roof of our building. How do we do that? And I was like, that's literally the opposite of the work at Hyperex. How do I do this? And that was one of my first jobs. So I get what you're saying, and I do genuinely enjoy that. I think where maybe you said you're doing your PhD or going on to your you're furthering your education. Do you think the educational routes in safety enable people to feel comfortable and confident in that position of responsibility?
Can you ever train to be a head of health and safety? I don't know. I think I've gone off recently the word train. I think I prefer the word educate people rather than train people. So I think maybe from that perspective, is you don't tell people what you have to do, but you educate people on a framework to be able to make decisions, rather than saying you do A, B, and C. So I think I've moved away from that term training, which is why I suppose I'm a big fan of the academic side of things, although my journey in safety started by developing as an environmental health officer in the army. So okay. That's obviously academic degree level, but it's really started off from a safety perspective, doing the NEBOSH certificate, then the MVQ route. But I think it goes back to that competency framework, isn't it? How do you make somebody competent?
Between competence and confidence as well.
And it's how do you do it? And it's one of these soft skills that perhaps we don't necessarily develop as safety professionals. I don't know how many people, anecdotally, a lot of people move into safety, I suppose. Oh, I'm going to try and be funny as a health and safety person, accidentally, like I did. That's a bad joke. I do apologize.
Yeah, everybody. It was. That's worst joke on the podcast.
I was looking for a different career in the military, and literally environmental health officer or environmental health technician was the next course starting that a direct civilian qualification and experience. So I accidentally ended up that. I didn't really know much. It seemed like a good idea at the time. And then following a more academic route with experience already, perhaps that helped shape me in my experiences beforehand, where I was very much looking at the I suppose risk was a big thing of what I did beforehand. So perhaps having that wider understanding maybe of a business or risk and the scope and appetite for risk and things like that, maybe subconsciously that helped develop me more than any particular courses. But those courses gave me that safety framework or food safety or fire safety, whatever sort of area we're looking at, to help focus those skills. There's more and more people who seem to be joining our profession from a school, college, university perspective, but still very much dominated people as a second, third, or even fourth career.
How do you nurture it within your team? So like if your team has a dilemma where they're, let's say like they're in a situation where they're being asked to make that risk-based decision, that there is this choice of going like gold standard safety, right? Rip the carpets out, take the curtains down. We'll stick with fire just because it's really simple, example, right? But then their operations are like, no, we want to make this really like really, really homely. I want like not just carpets and curtains. I want like tables and lamps and sofas, all in the means of escape. I want like create a library wall along there. And I'm literally describing some of the places I used to work, right? But like you want all of this stuff, so that it feels like this beautiful home. And there is these two extremes, and this poor safety professional in the middle that's in your team that's being asked to make the decision to find the middle ground, being pulled from one side to the other. How do you nurture them to make the decision? Like, what would you say to me if I was like, Phil, I don't know how to make this decision?
I suppose, taking back, when I joined, I had three health and safety leads who had been quite experienced in the organisation. So it was very quickly, it was very quick for me to learn about the team, understand their appetite for risk, their understanding, their knowledge, and trust them, and they trust me in the judgments they make. But with a new person, again, it's building up a trust with the people who work for you, with your team. And at first, it's a case of, let me know what the questions you're being asked by email, or if people have rung you up, so I can give you guidance. And it's rather than saying say A, B, and C to them, is to try to tease it out of them what the advice they could be giving, not should be giving, but what could they be giving, because there's different types of advice depending on the exact situation. And so it's trying to tease out, give suggestions to them, so they can come up with some good advice to give to the manager of the home or whoever they're dealing with. And I think that works better in the long term, say, as have in previous organisations. It's building up that rapport and trust with your colleagues, so they know that they you trust them to, and that empowers them to make decisions, but knowing that they've got you to fall back on, so they could they say, you know, give a bit of advice, but then copy me in and say, you know, can you sign it off, or anything to add to the observations, Phil, something like that. So it's building up that confidence of them, building up that trust both ways, to because I can't be at all our homes 24 hours a day. I can't be with the health and safety leads 24 hours a day. Not that we were people 24 hours a day, but so you need to develop that trust in their abilities, why they were recruited initially into the organisation that I've come and joined later after them, but also when you bring people into the organisation, you part of the interview process is getting an understanding of them, seeing what motivates them, seeing asking them questions that perhaps they might not be expecting to be asked, but seeing some sort of thought process they go through, almost like a risk assessment process they go through, to see if they've got that ability to work with you and the team. And so that's, yeah, so that sort of boils down, if one word answer would be trust.
And like how it sounds to me is also not just trust, but like, well, it is trust. It's like two-way trust, isn't it? Like, they know that you trust them to make the decision because you've employed them and you put them in that role because you think they're competent to do it. But then also they can kind of operate with the trust of the, for lack of a better phrase, like, Phil's got my back kind of thing. Not that it's us versus them. And obviously that's not what we're trying to nurture, that relationship we're trying to. But ultimately those difficult conversations can come and will come. But knowing that there is someone behind it. How do you... What about like a, because you're working, like you say, over hundreds of properties, but yet a relatively small team. What would your thoughts on like a safety professional that doesn't have a head of safety, but they're just themselves, which is, I think, is a case for nearly the majority of our profession. They're on their own. How have you kind of navigated that, or would advise to navigate that for someone who's a safety professional on their own and doesn't have someone that has their back, in a sense, or they don't feel like that in a way, at least?
Well, I suppose reflecting back on my career, I've never really been in that position myself. I've always been part of large organisations with the resources to either have myself have a boss or people work for me. And I suppose thinking about it, that if you are a health and safety manager in a small, medium-sized enterprise, actually you're the head of health. See yourself as the head of health and safety, not just the health and safety manager, because if there's no other safety professional above you at direct level or whatever, you are effectively the head of health and safety. So as a person, I would advise people not to think of themselves, the job title may say health and safety manager, advisor, coordinator or whatever, but think of themselves as the head of health and safety. Make those decisions and make those assessments as, you know, you are the boss when it comes to advice from a health and safety perspective.
There'll be positive affirmations in a way.
And I've not done that small, medium-sized enterprise, so it's, I do look at it and think, I'm lucky that I've got all those resources, not just from a safety perspective, but other people around the organisation who have perhaps dealt with an issue before, something similar, whether it be from a safety perspective, they're a safety professional or non-safety professional. And I know I've got operational people around me that I can ask for advice as well. So in some respects, it's a very different job, I think, working for an SME as the sole health and safety person to working as a health and safety person in a large organisation.
Okay.
So they're not. Yeah, sorry, go on.
No, I was going to you carry on, because I was going to change the subject. So feel free to finish off.
I was just going to wonder aloud, is that what level of organisation, what size of organisation do you stop being a health and safety person and just, not just is the wrong word to use, and become a manager of health and safety people rather than actually being a health and safety person yourself? At what level organisation?
Oh, okay, I see what you mean. Like, you're not really, don't take this as an offence, you're not really a safety professional anymore, you're a manager of safety professionals. Okay, I see where you're going. That's an interesting question.
Because I'm sure at some stage yourself, it's been good to see your consultancy business flourish and expand. At what stage will you become the managing director, full stop, chief executive officer, and no longer do anything involved in safety?
Do you know what?
And things like that.
I feel it now, if I'm honest, Phil. Like I'm going to the point where like I'm going back to doing technical work, and like, so Peter's off at the moment. And if when Peter's off, there's me and Carly, and then I slot in and do some of like the technical work that Peter does, and I'm like, well, the stuff I'm producing is terrible compared to what Peter's doing. Now Peter is a unique and very intelligent man, so like I don't want to compare myself to Peter, but ultimately like I can feel the skills fade in myself. Our main fire assessor Dan, who works for us as well, he's been helping me on a fire assessment project we got for a huge venue in London. Really complicated building. We've done it over like a series of fire assessments. And
I know the building you mean.
Yeah, and I've done one of the fire assessments and he's done the other nine. And I just happened to give myself what I thought would be the easiest one and actually turned out to be the hardest one. But that aside, looking at his work, how he's a lot quicker than me doing it, I'd say he's probably a lot more detailed than me. I'm not painting a very good picture of myself, but ultimately it's because I think when you know when they say surround yourself with people better than you, that's what I'm going to use to justify it. But ultimately what I'm finding is that there is a bit of that skills fade, but actually, to your point, when you get to that point where you are actually starting to have more managerial tasks than you are technical or like doing tasks, your doing tasks, I think, drop off really quickly because you realize that when you do a doing task, you're not 100% focused on it. Or at least, myself is trying to run a business. I'm literally like doing a fire assessment. At the same time, 50% of my brain's on, right, I've got invoices to people, or like I've got to get this lead, or I've got to convert that, or I've got to do this. And then, I need this one-to-one with Peter, and then I've got this. And then, Carly's on holiday next week. And your brain is just going loads. And that's no different from like a manager of a big safety team. I think it happens really quick. I think once you go past like one or two people that you're managing, I think it probably happens really quick after that.
Yeah, I think it happened really quick to me when I became a head of health and safety. And it goes back to talking about early about trust, is that you trust your team, that if somebody calls you up, you can say, well, I sort of got an idea. However, let me just refer to one of my colleagues, and then I can trust my colleagues to then give me unfiltered, honest advice to me, because they're far more used to that operational side in many respects. They're more used to the technical details of it. So I suppose I'm at that level where I'm a lot of my time is spent on budgets, mid-year appraisals, interviews and managing the team. But I'm not at the level, and I don't think I would like to be, where I would never touch safety again, because I think where I work at the moment is that perfect mix between the responsibilities of leadership and management, but still being able to spend enough time on the core of my role. So I'm perhaps in that sweet spot in an organisation that's big enough to have the resources, but also it's not that big that I would never that I wouldn't become a manager of a safety team rather than a safety professional who also manages people.
Interesting. No, it's definitely an interesting transition that I think anyone and everyone who gets into that managing role, I think will experience, whether it's through their own business like me or managing for a bigger business like yourself. It's been one I've found interestingly challenging as well. Probably not as challenging. It's probably more challenging than I thought it would be, actually. Not that I don't trust my team, but allowing yourself to trust the team as well. Like, I think when you're particularly, my experience is, my career is quite different in the fact that for a lot of my career, I was the only safety person. And then it was only probably the last couple of jobs where I was working at NHS or like a big kind of care sector where I had a team I could kind of fall back on. So I've been quite used to my whole career like making a decision and doing it myself. And then I go and start a business, and that is 100% like what, like I'm the safety professional in this business. And at that point, there was just me and the wife. So if kind of not what I say goes, because that definitely doesn't happen. Sherry is probably what Sherry says goes, but ultimately, like if it's safety, I was the only one that knew in the business. So then interestingly, when Peter joined, it was like, oh, there's a different opinion. And it was like a little bit of a transition for me to allow that to happen. And I think there's a difference of like not allowing it and to allowing it and feeling uncomfortable with it, I think is natural. But like people that maybe like, I don't think it's like a bad thing. It's just like a natural thing, isn't it? Where like you're a bit scared to not be good enough. Is that, I don't know if I'm making sense here, if I'm honest.
I think I know where you're coming from. I probably won't use the word scared. In fact, I think about this, are they reading about imposter syndrome and things like that?
Yeah, it's probably a lot.
That's probably a better term to use than saying that. Hey, you're meant to be interviewing me. I'm not meant to be interviewing you.
It's a two-way conversation, baby. I think that's probably the best way to put it, actually, is that imposter syndrome, because I can see it in me and in our team as well. And like, I find what I'm finding interesting as a manager now is looking at the team and knowing who is right for what job, if that makes sense. So I get a job in, I'm like, oh, that's Peter through and through. And then I look at that and I'm like, oh, that's a bit Carly, that. And then I'm like, oh, that's definitely Dan. That's mine. And I think I would be the best person. So I think a lot of imposter syndrome is knowing that you can't be good at everything, but knowing what you are good at. So it's like knowing your weaknesses and knowing your strengths. It's that old like SWOT analysis, right?
It is, but I thought it's also is understanding that there are key concepts about what we do. There are key concepts in whatever field you're in. I'm maybe sound a bit blasé about that, but if you are good at understanding the key concepts, you're good at then applying the situation to the key concepts. You can work in almost any industry. Yes, some industries may have more complexities and regulations about them. It may take you a few months rather than a few weeks to adapt to that industry. But I think the sign of a good safety professional is that ability to go to those core concepts, to be able to then apply those and gather that information from the HSE's website or Google or whatever you're using. Yeah. And then make that, I think the key thing here is make that pragmatic operational decision. To work with operations, don't just do that in isolation. And so I think that that is one way of looking at it. And then perhaps people who are working alone as the sole safety person within an organization is to still maintain that discipline, to maintain that way of working. And I appreciate it's probably harder sometimes if they don't have fellow health and safety professionals to just bounce ideas off. I can, you're probably quite lonely at one stage when you're a sole trader and just yourself with no other person to help you with those decisions. So it'd be interesting if people listening to this were to give their experiences of what it's like being a sole person in an organisation, whether it be as a consultant or whether it be an organisation that they're working for permanently, is how they manage that, being that sole person with nobody else in the safety side.
I think as well, like that's the nice thing about seeing like these little extra communities that are popping up, whether people are creating new platforms or it's a community like what PM used to be when I did that, and then also what like Safe Tribe is now. These things that are just these extra little communities that are probably not bound by the professional body in a way, and it is just a free space to build friendships and relationships where we can go there and, for lack of a better phrase, like rant about our employer in a way and these difficult things that we're having without fear of not so much repercussions, but without that kind of it's not really any judgment either. I don't think it's more just that ability to know that I can only really speak for when I was part of the network, but ultimately, like what I felt in PM/ the network was, we didn't really give a crap who you worked for and where you worked. It was like we were all just there to, like, listen to people's challenges and then try and help each other solve those problems. I think that's definitely something I experienced was really helpful, and it's nice to see more of that coming up now, actually, because that was non-existent when I started. Didn't exist.
Yes, I see where you're coming from, and I joined the safety tribe. That's, is it Amy Stillwell Cox running that?
Yeah, safe tribe, yeah.
I've probably not been on as much as I could, but I do enjoy mentoring and helping people. But I suppose going back to when I was first appointed a head of health and safety, in fact, I was an interim head of health and safety initially, is one of the business leaders had a really good conversation with them about, I suppose, about leadership. And so it wasn't a formal lesson, it was just a chat. And one of the key things I took away was finding a friend within the organisation.
Yeah.
So this is not within my chain of command, it's somebody just outside of my chain of, I shouldn't use the terminology like that, somebody outside the department I'm working in. Somebody you can have non-judgmental cups of tea, coffees or whatever with to talk about issues, and they trust you and let you just have a little bit of a talk about what you're doing and where you may have problems or thinking about decisions. So having that company or organizational friend, and ideally they'd be sort of like on a similar management level as you, so they can see the pressures you're at from above and from below. And I found that was absolutely superb advice. So wherever I've worked, I've always been fortunate to find a company friend to be able to have open and honest conversations with, and that's been really, really beneficial. So that's something I would advise people to really consider if they're perhaps feeling well, they may be the only safety person in the organization, but I'm sure the people who they work with and colleagues who they could have candid conversations with that can then help form their ideas and proposals and help develop them as well. So that's something I found really, really useful.
Mm. I think that probably echoed even more as well when running a business. One of the best things I ever did was join a community of business owners where we literally once a month meet up just down south, kind of border of London, and there is literally a section on the agenda that is just for ranting. So we literally just sit in there and everyone goes around and tells what crap has happened this week. And sometimes it is just, well, this month, sorry. Sometimes it is just like, oh, moan, moan, moan. But then sometimes actually someone will say something that is quite deep. And we just watching the room sometimes like we'll come together and just help someone, and even if it is just a little moan and stuff, we all try and help each other. But for me, the ability to go there, talk to people that go through similar challenges, that like I have safety friends, which are nice to talk safety challenges, but like a lot of them I work for, like heads of safety for this and that, and it's just like they can't relate to, like, I don't know what my cash flow looks like for next month or something like that. Like those weird challenges, like I don't think unless you've run a small business, you don't have that appreciation for it. And that's not a bad thing.
No.
Or a bad, good thing. It just is, right? So being able to do that was huge for me. I remember in December last year, I was like, just, I'll be honest, I was struggling. It was really, really hard. And a friend of mine who also runs a business, he was like, you need to come down. Just try it. I think you need it. I think it'd be really helpful. It's like the best thing I ever did. Best few grand I ever spent. We don't actually come away with anything. Like sometimes people will be like, what do you get out of it? And it's like, I can't really explain. Like I just know that I've got some friends there to talk to that get it. Do you know what I mean? And I think you're right, mate. I think it is so, so, so important of having that sounding board.
I'm a member of a couple of professional organisations, and back in the day I was I used to go to their regular meetings and attend them. I spoke at a few of them, but I don't seem to have been to many in the last few years. It's perhaps not the right format for me to get any benefits, although perhaps going to meetings shouldn't be all about what you can benefit getting out of it. It should be also about what you can give to the meeting and give other people. But sometimes when time's very precious, that's quite difficult to justify going to meetings and conferences and things like that.
Yeah, I found those places like professional body networks and stuff like that. I feel like they're not the place for that. It feels very like quite stiff, and you know, about kind of career development and and reserved in what we say. Like, I think there's a difference of having a community which is designed, or even if it's not a community, it's just a one-to-one, you and, like you said, a work friend or something like that, having that space to, you know, like, crack open a beer and just be like verbal diarrhea in a sense, isn't it? I think it is so important. I really like that, man. I think there's a lot of sense in that. I have one last thing to ponder before we move on to the question from the audience that we've got. I was wondering what your opinion of interventions are. Like, does an intervention ever work? Is there a time where it's good to intervene on a job? So I'll give you some context. I don't know, I put a little video out this morning. I don't know if you had a chance to watch it, but basically I touched on that.
I've been working on my day job, not watching YouTube, James. I've got to
just in case everyone's listening. I'm working hard, really hard. So it's really simple. A guy was climbing, so just the two doors down from me, they're having a loss conversion. I would say it's not the best managed site for safety wise. Like, the ladder is kind of locked off at the end of the night to stop any like kids going at it, with just a plank of wood and some rope around it that you, and a bow knot that you could literally just pull and climb up if you want to. So that gives you an insight, the general tone of the site maybe. And then so there was a youngish lad, I'd probably say maybe 20s, late 20s maybe, climbing up the ladder. Got like six kind of planks of wood on his side, maybe about 3 meters long each, just in one, on one shoulder, and then the other hand on his ladder, takes two steps up, let go of the ladder, grabs onto the next one, and obviously he doesn't fall, but I chose not to intervene, and I've actually never ever been comfortable with doing interventions. Whenever I have, I found that it becomes a very negative conversation immediately, and my thought process to that is that an intervention feels immediately targeted at the person that's behaving in a certain way without little consideration of the reasons as to why they're behaving like that. So this person is just trying to do their job today, get the job done, and ultimately what's wrong with that picture is nothing to do with him climbing up the ladder. It's the fact that when we designed the job, we didn't put a hoist on a scaffold so that he doesn't need to take it up. So really it's kind of not in his control. So I've always found interventions not a good thing, and I tend not to do them. However, I've also never had a situation where I haven't intervened and something's gone wrong, in which case I feel like I would probably change my opinion on interventions. But I appreciate people's stance of like, but what if he'd have fell off that ladder? You'd have felt like you'd have felt like you'd let him down in a way. And what's your opinion of that kind of situation?
Okay. I suppose all health and safety professionals have this thing that if a contractor comes round to your own house to do some work, do you let them know that you work in health and safety and maybe frighten them off?
I like to do it really bad and then I give them a business card.
I actually intervened a few weeks ago. I was travelling home and I went to the services as you do for a pit stop. Started to dry my hands and smoke started coming out the dryer. So okay. The isolation was just above me. So I turned that off and the shop was just across there. So I went to the shop assistant and said, look, there's a fire. It was smoke pouring out of the hand dryer. Can you get maintenance or a manager to come and sort it out? Yeah. And they were like, yeah, okay, I'll go and get a manager. Thank you very much. And that's it. I'll go and stand by the dryer and I'll wait there until somebody comes in case it escalates. And then somebody wandered up to me and said, they're the duty manager. And I said, yeah, smoke coming out of here. I isolated it. I think you need to get your maintenance person here to have a look. And the person, yeah, okay. And then they started to wander off, said, look, are you going to get somebody? Yeah, I'll get around to it, sort of attitudes. I said, right, if somebody's not here within a minute, I'm going to hit the fire alarm. I work in health and safety. And I thought, as soon as I said, oh, my wife was with me. And as soon as I said that, I thought, oh, no. But as soon as I said that, I'll hit the alarm and work in health and safety. This person, this sort of sprung up, said, I'll get on it straight away. And like 30 seconds later, they got on the radio and the maintenance person came in and started doing the business. So that was sort of an intervention that I felt that I couldn't just ignore smoke coming out of a hand dryer. Whether it would have caused a fire or not, probably not, because it was a tiled wall, all that sort of stuff. But that was, yeah, when I said I work in health and safety, I was thinking, no, why did I say that? But, you know, I couldn't have left.
The severity of your situation seems quite immediately obvious and could escalate quite quickly. Like something's gone wrong.
Yeah, it wasn't seeing a contractor doing something dodgy. And on that, I suppose, when as part of the way we try to educate people is that if somebody at one of our sites sees a contractor doing something they think is dodgy, we just try to educate people to say, ask them to pause the activity from a professional workplace perspective and let's review what they're doing, whether get in touch with myself or somebody from the facilities team or whatever. Yep. It's never stop it and kick them off site. It's going back to that pause. But in a work environment, if you're the responsible person for that work environment, you've got that authority to ask contractors to pause and review. Whereas if you're just wandering past shopping, it's a different matter, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's the interesting thing here, isn't it? Is it's like, I feel like we're one of very few professions that are kind of, we expect ourselves to never stop working in a way. It's quite interesting. Like, if I'm in work, it's literally my job to intervene. Now, I still would apply some of my stance to even in job. I have rarely stopped work, actually, unless I have done it several times, but like, normally it's more just a curiosity, which I think is just a difference in way of approaching an intervention. So I still am doing an intervention. So I would do it in work is probably my way of doing it. I probably just get a bit of a stick up my back the way that we do it sometimes. But it's when we seem obligated in our profession to do it out of work that I feel uncomfortable. You wouldn't expect a roofer to drive past someone who doing a poor standard roof and go, actually, that's not how you lay that tile. But yet in safety, we kind of seem to expect that of ourselves, which I find very strange.
I try not to be negative and rant, but sometimes people post a picture on LinkedIn of what they think is dodgy behavior. Mm. And then you have hundreds of people making thousands of words comments about what was going wrong, blah blah, and you're thinking, no, you don't understand the context behind it at the moment in time that picture was taken. And that's a similar sort of thing. If you're driving or walking past something, if you haven't got the context that moment in time, it could be they're temporarily taken off off one lanyard to attach another one, and you just see that moment in time between moving and changing positions and things like that. So it is really difficult to intervene. And as well, sticking my food safety hat on, I do sometimes, well, most of the time, I double check to see what score it's got on the door before I eat in places. Mm. So perhaps that's part of my profession that I do take into my home life. When do you switch off? You know, do you wait to get told off by your children that there's some out-of-date food in the fridge, or you've put it on the wrong shelf? I'm just admitting to all my inadequacies really now.
I think it's one that probably warrants a much longer conversation, but it kind of comes back as well to what you were talking about earlier in like, are we even taught to navigate like an intervention, when to intervene, how to intervene? We're not really even given those skills, are we, in our educational routes?
As an enforcement officer, going back to my development as environmental health first and foremost with enforcement powers, although it was in the army, so I didn't have any formal enforcement powers, I spent a number of weeks attached to local authorities. That is part of the development. How do you issue out notices, etc.? But looking at Irish membership, what's 45,000 people or something in Irish, and in the CIH, there's about 8,000 to 9,000 of the HOs. So, yeah, vast majority of people perhaps won't have been mentored, educated, made aware of how they can make interventions, whether it be in the workplace or whether it's outside the workplace. Something for me to bear in mind, something for us all to bear in mind. But it goes back to the early question, is how do you train to be how are you educated or made aware to be a health and safety person?
It's a lot more complex than I think we originally approached. in our education audience. Okay, right. Let's move on to a question from one of the listeners. I think, do you know Sam Greensip?
No,
I'm going to say everyone knows Sam, but obviously,
all right. Okay. I'm obviously not on social media enough.
So Sam Greensip, I know relatively well, mostly over LinkedIn, which is the way we know people nowadays.
Isn't yeah, it is. But,
He's given us a nice question, an interesting question, which I think you'll be able to contribute to. And we kind of touched on earlier as well. How do safety professionals find their place in the bigger picture of the organization?
Interesting question. Deserves some thought before I start.
You need to answer immediately.
So. Immediately. All right. work with the operational line. Get to understand what are the priorities of the organization you're working for starters. Am I about to say this? Safety is not first. Mm. The first priority of an organization, whether not for profit, whether commercial organization making profits for their investors, etc., is to make a surplus. Is to have an income, because without having an income, without having a surplus, you've got no money to invest. You've got no money to develop. You can't run a business or an organization to provide goods and services that people need and people want. So to me, it's that operational imperative is understand from an operational perspective how the organization works, what are its aims, how has it achieved those aims, and ask questions about finances, ask questions to see how, say, if you're going to an individual site, how's that individual site doing in terms of their operational KPIs, in terms of, you know, ask questions about their occupancy rates, the P&L rates, and all those things. And if you're working closely with facilities, and I think health and safety profession is very, very close to facilities or property or whatever you call it, is rather than just saying do A, B, and C, say, right, okay, I've got a couple of options. How much does option A cost? How much does option B cost? What's the ROI? And also ask those sorts of questions so you understand the business, you understand the flow of the business, its reporting schedule, and why the business is in existence and how it generates funding to be able to fund its continued existence and have that surplus to invest in the people, to pay investors and carry out its aims. So it's operations, and then finance and facilities. You need to get to know those and work with those closely.
Yeah.
Mate, next question.
I think it's such a good point. I think that a business exists to do whatever that business exists to do, right? So, I find kind of in line with something I was pondering the other week, actually, in that the safety profession, in a way, and I'm tarring us all with a bad brush, which I do often, I suppose, but it's kind of like we moan quite a lot that we're treated like a bolt-on to the business, like, oh, we're always invited last, we're never included in the conversation, you know, or they do everything else and then they'll go and do all this safety work that we need them to do, and we kind of get frustrated that we're very much treated like a bolt-on, the work we're doing is treated like a bolt-on. But I do find the manner in which we do a lot of our work encourages it to be a bolt-on, if that makes sense. So, like, we will create campaigns like you alluded to, like Safety First. We will create a whole separate standalone thing that just feels like all it's actually trying to do is achieve a safer workplace. Yeah. That is ultimately what we are trying to achieve. I get that. But if you create a separate campaign and a separate approach and then don't complain that it's not being included in the main operation, but taking our time to understand what are we actually trying to achieve. And I would actually say that it's interesting that you're, I think a lot of us would say that, but ultimately doing it, I probably learn more how to do that working in the care and healthcare sector more than anything, because ultimately it was kind of like, if you want to put Sheila here, for example, because that is, you know, she's in a, you know, latter stages of her life, it's very hard to turn around and say no, she can't do that, and you can't have that nice room because of this and that and this and that. And you are kind of forced in a way to really understand, okay, why do we need to put Sheila there? Why do we need to go? What's this situation? Why can't we go over here? And I can't go there because of this. Can't do that because of this. Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. We just need to make this kind of work then. You are kind of forced in a way to think like that, which I think is really good. A really good thing. I'm not saying that other businesses don't do that, but I think you're forced for it to be less of a lip service in those sectors, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you've got that immediate, and it actually goes back to the sort of area I'm looking at with my PhD research, is that how can you put in place procedures, ways of working, culture, behaviours, and all those sorts of things to encourage people who are on the front line, who are the operator on the front line, to almost do a mini risk assessment without thinking about is how do they lift somebody, how do they transport some paints or chemicals, they've just had a delivery, how do they make it safe temporarily because they need to work to do something until they can put the delivery weights. It's just like a micro risk assessment, and how can you put in place that, and it's you know, we talk about, you know, behavioral safety, safety culture and things like that, but we sometimes miss those basics about what's it written down? What policy and procedures do you have in place, and ways of working, education awareness courses behind that behavioural safety, behind the safety culture? And I think sometimes we, in our profession, to try to do the latest thing, it's easy to miss some of those basics you need in place before you start doing, dare I say, the sexy part of safety.
It's so true. Like, we do a lot of kind of big cultural behavioral stuff, but I tell you what, 90% of the time we'll get called into a customer, come on, we want to do this big cultural transformation, blah blah blah. We get there and we're like, before we do that, we just got to sort this crap out first, because like, ain't no one reading this. This risk assessment is ticking all the boxes of what the HSE says is wrong. And I actually asked, I was watching an IOSH panel for Stuart and Arup. IOSH and Arup have done the Future of the Safety Professional report, which is actually a good report. And was watching the panel. I think there's some bits in there that are quite good. But one of the challenges I had for them in the panel, one of the questions that I had for them was, we can talk about all this stuff, and I think a lot of those stuff they raised as the future challenges are relevant, but ultimately I asked exactly your point. The HSE did the paper on good practice and pitfalls of risk assessment in 2003, so that was 20 years ago they did a paper, and I still see those pitfalls on risk assessments generated not only by business people or operational people, but by safety professionals as well. We are still not very good at the basics of safety, and yet we're here talking about all of this new sexy stuff. Is there a point to go back to basics?
If I hadn't started my PhD, I'd have looked at the report in a completely different lens and really welcomed it. But when I started looking at it with an academic hat on, I was starting thinking it's not really referencing that much academic research. And I think area as a profession, I don't think we're doing as well as we should be doing. I think it is.
That's a good point.
It's sad, the sad demise of the safety journal that I used to publish every quarter. That was really good for conversations and to read and see where the latest research and development was. So I think perhaps, hopefully it's not down to just me. Fortunately, there are a couple of other safety people on my cohort that I'm doing my PhD with as well. So I think there are more and more people who are looking at what we do through the rigors of academic research, because something we think as safety professionals, it might have worked in a previous organisation. It seems a good idea. I saw it on LinkedIn or whatever. Unless you start rigorously investigating it and having evidence-based practice, you don't really know whether you could be doing better. You might be doing something absolutely superb, but let's put a bit of academic rigor around some of these things, so then we can shout out about these things. I suppose I've been fortunate that my career to date, I've been in organisations that aren't at the bad end of safety. They've always had a relatively good safety culture, so it's been... I haven't faced the same issues that a lot of my fellow professionals have had to face with going into somewhere that literally has nothing in place. So it's difficult for me to look at it through that lens and look at it through an organization being in a terrible state.
But I do think you raise a really good point in that there is a distinct lack of evidence-based practice at all in safety. And I think everyone will probably reference at this point to disagree with us that, you know, there's a whole movement around safety science, for example. But you need to spend 10 minutes reading any popular book in safety and just see a distinct lack of referencing, which just tells, you know, there's some very, very, very popular books in safety that you just like, there is little to no references in here that shows me any academic rigor or any safety, any scientific rigor off the back of this. I do think sometimes you might genuinely just want to try something that you can't find any
give it a go,
but there is a distinct lack of going even to the HSE. The HSE science department is good. They've got some really good papers there. Granted, there's a lot to dig through, but ultimately, yeah, there's a lot of good stuff there that we could really learn from. The other HSE paper was where they just basically said the classroom-based manual handling training doesn't work. Yeah, it's probably still one of the biggest revenue earners in the safety industry. Still now, it's just I could go on all day with that for sure. It's a severe lack of scientific rigor and safety.
Although I'm going to apologize in advance and saying Rebranding Safety is not my favorite safety podcast. Sorry, it's
safety
of work.
Yeah.
Safety of work with
it's mine as well.
It's really good, and I can see that they're two academics that got a lot of understanding of academic research, and they talk about in each of their podcast episodes an academic paper, really honestly. And I think that's one of the things that inspired me to carry on my studies and take them back up. Some really good papers that they've talked about and they've been involved in themselves, like the one on safety clutter springs to mind.
Their paper, Drew. Yeah, that's really good. That's one of my favorites.
Superb paper. Or linked into that one I've been reading recently is about the no blame culture is actually perhaps not as wonderful as we've been thinking. But yeah, it's looking at those papers, and it's trying to look at something that's got some evidence base. But yeah, you're right. Yeah. Sometimes in situations happening, you have to go back to basics, do a risk assessment, make a decision, put in place a policy, procedure, a way of working, a way of monitoring, and then. But here's the problem: is we don't always have time to go back and then look at the research, look at the statistics around it. Did that intervention, was that intervention good? Did it work? Was it effective? Was it a good return on investment? Or perhaps we should have used our resources for something else. But that's. But because a lot of the time we're working in dynamic situations and things change, things happen all the time. It is sometimes difficult to make a list and take a step back and look at all these issues and your interventions. So that's what I'm hoping to try to turn around my way of thinking to do a little bit more of that.
I like it, mate. I like it. Really cool. Right, that's just over an hour. We've gone over there, Phil, but a great place to leave that there. Thank you very much for your time. You said you're like quite keen on mentoring and stuff. Are you still mentoring? Or do you want to give a shout out to any of the? Do you want to give a shout out to anything? Basically, it's a question that I'm.
Do asking. I give a shout out to anything? I would like to give a shout out, and if anybody who's got a bit of an academic background, a degree or a master's, to encourage them to look at doing a professional doctorate like I'm doing. There's a number of universities around the UK that offer that. If anyone who wants any advice, guidance, and support, please reach out to me on LinkedIn, Phil Clark, if you can find me. There is information about there. There's some really good programs out there. And if you live in England, I'm not so sure about the funding in Northern Ireland, Wales and Scotland, but if you live in England, Student Finance England will loan you up to £25,000 to cover the course fees, whether it be 3 years full time or, as I'm doing it, 5 to 6 years to help towards you the course fees. So that's really is just want to say is have confidence to at least have discussions with it to embark on that program. And the more of us who embark on that program, I think it can only benefit our profession overall. And let's leave it at that, James.
No, a great place to leave it. I like it, mate. Thank you very much for coming on, buddy. I appreciate your time and your insight. It's been an interesting conversation.
It's good we finally managed to do it. So, yeah, really appreciate it. Thank you very much, James, for your time.
No problem.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.